I didn't know much about money growing up. I got my first job and just kind of spent it. With Acorns Early, your kids don't have to get their money lessons the hard way. Start taking small steps today. Let them learn by doing and watch their potential grow for tomorrow. Because no matter what your kids grow up to be, they're going to have to deal with money, so you might as well start building those skills now. With Acorns Early, they can learn by doing and watch as the small steps they take today grow into big potential for tomorrow. Acorns Early lets kids learn by doing. They can earn money with the in-app chores tracker, practice real-life budgeting with automatic allowances, and even set their own savings goals. We've been using it for our youngest and he loves it. He feels so special having his own debit card, and I can really see him prioritizing the things that he wants to buy. Ready to join over 1.2 million parents and kids who've unlocked their kids' potential with Acorns Early? Get your first month on us when you head to acornsearly.com/ATTWG or download the Acorns Early app. That's 1 month free when you sign up at acornsearly.com/ATTWG.
Acorns Early Card is issued by Community Federal Savings Bank, member FDIC, pursuant to license by MasterCard International. Free trial for new subscribers only. Subscription fee starting from $5 per month unless canceled. Terms apply at acorns.com/early terms.
Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's revolutionizing how we deal with life's challenges, from sleepless nights to stress-filled days. Mood.com has created an entire line of functional gummies that target specific health concerns with 100% federally legal THC blends. Even better, you can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code ATTWG. If you're like me, then you have different family members who have different ailments, and I've recommended Mood to all of them. I legitimately, before recording this, I told my mom about Mood, and she's going to make her first order. Because they have gummies for all sorts of things, for pain relief, for sleeping, for just improving your mood. Their gummies are specially blended and each one feels different. The Sleepy Time gummies knock me out in 15 minutes flat with no hangovers, no grogginess, and I wake up feeling amazing. And each gummy is crafted using federally legal cannabis grown on small, family-owned American farms. Best of all, not only does Mood stand behind everything with an industry-leading 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but, as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code ATTWG. So head to Mood.com, browse their amazing selection of functional gummies, and find the perfect gummy for whatever you're dealing with. And remember to use promo code ATTWG at checkout to save 20% on your first order. The holidays are almost here, and if you still have names on your list, don't panic. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. You'll discover presents that feel meaningful and personal, never rushed or last minute. Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the U.S., so every gift feels special and thoughtfully chosen. Here are a few things that I'm getting. Unlock the Beer Escape Room. It's a cute little cage that you could put a six-pack of beer in, and then you have to do an escape room to get the code to open the cage. I am absolutely getting this for my brother-in-law because this is in his wheelhouse in every way. The DIY Root Beer Science Kit I'm getting for my 8-year-old because he has recently discovered root beer and he likes learning. So this is going to be a really fun project for the both of us. So don't wait. Make this holiday the year you give something truly unforgettable. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/ATTWG. That's uncommongoods.com/ATTWG for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods. We're all out of the ordinary.
Darkcast Network. Welcome to the dark side of podcasting.
Aisha Degree was a bright, talented, happy 9-year-old living with her parents and brother in Shelby, North Carolina. She was an excellent student and the star of her basketball team. She was surrounded by grandparents, aunts, uncles, and cousins. There was no shortage of love in Aisha's life. But in the early morning hours of February 14th, 2000, Aisha took her backpack that she had packed with several changes of clothes and slipped out of her house. Several motorists later reported seeing her walking alone in a rainstorm at around 4 a.m. Where was Aisha Degree going? What or who made her leave her home that night? After over 20 years, this remains one of the most confounding cases, not only in the small town of Shelby, but in the entire country. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell you the stories of those who never came home. Today, I want to tell you the story of Aisha Degree. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Everyone.
Welcome back.
Thank you for joining us once again. Again, I am Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And we are the husband and wife team behind this podcast. Each week, I tell you the story of an unsolved missing persons case. Ethan doesn't know anything about this going into the episode, and he's here to provide his reactions and questions in real time, hopefully asking some of the same ones that you're having at home right now. Before we get started this week, I want to give a special shout out to our newest member over on Patreon, Nicole P. Thank you so much for your support, Nicole. It really means a lot to us.
Thank you very, very much.
If you join us over on Patreon at any level, you can listen to these episodes early and ad-free. But now you also have the option of subscribing on Apple Podcasts, which will also get them ad-free for you.
Oh, and, nice.
Yeah, and on Apple, you get a two-week trial, free trial.
Mm.
So you can go ahead and do that as well. But anyway, with all of that business out of the way, let's get to the story of Aisha Degree. Aisha Jaquilla Degree was born on August 5th, 1990 in North Carolina to Harold and Aquila Degree. Aisha is the youngest of two children. Her brother O'Brien was born 11 months before her, so they were very close.
Wow.
The family lived in Shelby, North Carolina, which is a rural town about 45 miles outside of Charlotte.
Okay.
Aisha and O'Brien were relatively sheltered, with their lives basically revolving around family, school, and church. Now, a lot has been made of the fact over the years that the Degrees didn't have a computer in their home. Like, this is, you know, supposed to be like some big deal. But it was 2000, and I feel like a lot of people didn't have computers in their home necessarily.
I mean, I didn't. Well, 2000, I guess I did when I was in college, but like 1999, I didn't.
Yeah. See, I did, but, you know, it was like my brother's old computer, and he was, you know, he was older than me. He had already been to college. So, like, I got, you know, an old one of his. Though, you know, again, this reasoning is because, like, computers just weren't as ubiquitous then as they are now. And plus, you know, a lot of people just didn't really see the need to spend that much money because they were like a lot. I mean, you know, $1,000, $2,000. That reasoning doesn't really appear to be true for the Degrees. Aquila told Jet Magazine in 2013, quote, "We didn't even have a computer because every time you turned on the TV, there was some pedophile who had lured somebody's child away," end quote.
Interesting.
Yeah, it does seem like they were pretty overprotective, but like O'Brien did a Facebook Live, which I'll talk about a little bit ago, and he did this back in 2020, and he doesn't characterize his parents as like strict. You know, he said they got to go outside and play and all that. They just, you know, they were also 9 and 10.
Yeah.
So they just generally didn't have a lot of freedoms yet.
Yep.
So on that Facebook Live, he also said that his parents would discipline him and his sister, though he did say that it was usually him who would be getting disciplined because Aisha was a people pleaser. She did not like people to be mad at her. Like, she always tried to do the right thing. And, you know, O'Brien,
he was a little rambunctious boy.
Yeah, exactly. Right. He did say that he would receive whoopings, as he called them, but he doesn't seem to characterize this as abuse.
Okay.
Aisha was 9 years old in 2000, and she was in the fourth grade at Falston Elementary School. She was also a star basketball player playing point guard for her team. Aisha's parents describe her as a well-behaved kid, like I said. Like, she did not test boundaries. She was the one who just wanted to make everybody happy and basically did what her parents said. In an interview with the Charlotte Observer, her aunt, Patricia Banks, said, quote, "She doesn't even open the front door for me without getting her mother's permission, and I'm her aunt."
Wow.
Yeah. The weekend of Valentine's Day 2000 was a three-day weekend for Aisha and her brother, with school being closed on Friday, February 11th. That day, Harold and Aquila still had to work, so the kids spent the day at their cousin Keisha's house, who lived in the same neighborhood. Harold's mother also lived across the street from the family, and it seems as though the entire DeGree family was really tight-knit. Several family members lived in that neighborhood, and I think a lot of them lived together, because Aquila said in that Jet interview that I mentioned that her mother-in-law was across the street, but then I read in a separate article that, like, the kid's uncle lived across the street, so I think maybe they lived in the same house, and then, like, their oldest cousin, Keisha, who had babysat them, It's usually reported that it was their aunt who looked after them that day. And I think it might have been the same house, but it was actually their cousin who was looking at them. And apparently her sister would also watch them a lot. Like, it just seems like there's a ton of family all around this neighborhood.
Very close.
Yeah. That day, the Friday, like I said, they were with Keisha and both of the kids had basketball practice later in that afternoon. So they went to that practice as normal, which was held at their elementary school.
Maybe it's just this area, but, like, I'm shocked that an elementary school has a basketball team.
I don't think it's the elementary school basketball team. I think it's like a private thing that they just practice at the elementary school.
Gotcha.
Yeah. But either way, I mean, the kids were both, like, really into basketball at a young age, from what it sounds like.
Cool.
The next day, on Saturday, February 12th, both Aisha and her brother had basketball games. Now, as I said, Aisha was a star point guard, but in this game, she fouled out.
Oh.
And this maybe led to her team having their first loss of the season.
Oh.
Yeah, so she was understandably upset. I mean, so were her teammates. They were all apparently, like, crying at the end of the game, according to their coach. But, you know, she was also 9. So according to everyone who was there, like her parents, the coach, you know, everyone, she got over it pretty quickly. And so did the rest of her teammates. The family stayed to watch O'Brien's game, which was after hers. And then they went home. Now that evening, talk about this close family, Aisha had a sleepover with a dozen of her cousins.
A dozen?
Like,
cousins?
A straight up 12 plus. Somewhere between, like, 12 to 15 cousins.
Wow.
The sleepover was hosted by her 15-year-old cousin, Katina DeGree. Chanel DeGree, another one of Aisha's cousins who was at the slumber party, said that Aisha was happy that night and was dancing and laughing along with everyone else. And this is important because, you know, there have been a billion and a half theories about this case, And one of which is that what ends up happening is related to her being incredibly, like, upset over this basketball game.
Okay.
But, you know, based on everybody who was actually around her for the rest of the day on Saturday, it truly doesn't seem like that was the case. The next day, the family attended church at Macedonia Missionary Baptist Church, followed by lunch at one of their aunt's houses. Aisha was happy because she had received an early Valentine's gift from her grandmother, which was, of course, candy.
Right.
In true grandma fashion. Later that evening, however, Aisha seemed tired, you know, probably because of that sleepover with, like, a dozen of her cousins.
Yeah, I can't imagine there was a whole lot of sleeping at the sleepover.
Yeah, and this family doesn't seem like the type who would go to, like, the 10 or 11 a.m. service. So, like, they went to church the next morning. I'm betting it was pretty early. She also complained of having a headache, and according to Harold, Aisha went to bed early at around 6:30. However, a storm rolled in a few hours later, and the thunder and lightning woke Aisha up, so she rejoined the family in the den where they were all watching TV. Now, this is February, and it's North Carolina, so it's not like, you know, it was like snowing or anything like that, but it does get cold down there. And it was rainy and a little icy that night. And shortly after Aisha, you know, came out into the den, there was a car accident nearby where the car hit an electric pole and knocked out power in the neighborhood. And so this was around 9:30, somewhere in there. The house is completely dark, obviously. There's no more TV, no lights. And so Aquila and Harold told the kids to go to bed because, like, what else are you going to do?
Yeah.
And, you know, they, of course, were complaining, like, oh, I'm not even tired. But they're like, just go. Just lie down. Like, you know. So the kids got changed into their pajamas and went to bed. Aquila said that she kind of, like, stayed on the couch and just kind of dozed off a little bit and then woke up. And this timeline of, like, the night is really confusing because I've heard it's over 20 years, right? And, like, I've found in researching these cases that if you get a story that's this old, the timeline gets really funky.
Yeah, I mean, people misremember things. I mean, 20 years is a long time.
It's also like a game of telephone, you know?
Right.
You're saying one thing to a reporter. The reporter maybe writes down something else that gets picked up by a different report. It's like, who knows, right?
Yeah.
Now, I did see in a 2023 interview, so a very recent interview with Aquila, she's talking about putting the kids to bed and kind of dozing off on the couch. But in the original newspaper articles 23 years ago, her whereabouts aren't really mentioned in them. But Harold said that he ended up going to sleep around 12:30, and on his way to bed, he checked on Aisha and O'Brien, who shared a room, and saw that they were both in their bed sleeping.
What time? You said 12?
About 12:30.
12:30.
Now, in later stories written about Aisha, the timeline shifts a little bit. Now, this 12:30 check-in still happens, but apparently at some point, and I can't find the origin of this because it's not in the very first articles, but it's in everything that's, like, currently written about the case. So I don't know where this happened, but at some point, he says that he actually went to bed at 2:30 a.m. and checked on the kids again and saw them both in their beds at 2:30. I want to make it clear that the 12:30 time from the very first article is a direct quote from Harold. I've never seen a direct quote from Harold
saying
2:30.
Okay.
So I just don't know about that. And it's a little weird to me because Harold worked second shift at PPG, meaning that he would have likely started work around 7 a.m. So 2:30 seems like a pretty late bedtime to me.
Yeah.
Now, what makes more sense would be if he actually went to bed at 12:30, checked on the kids, and then got up to use the restroom or something at 2:30 and checked on them again.
Right.
Before going back to sleep. And again, I don't want it to sound like this disparity is due to anything nefarious. I just really think that it's accidental misinformation that we see in these cases.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, but it is a 2-hour time gap.
It is. And it's confusing because, again, in this 2023 interview, Aquila says that she checked on the kids a little bit after midnight. She says that it was because she was dozing on the couch. The power came back on and it, like, startled her awake.
Okay.
And so she wakes up. It's a little after midnight. She goes, checks on the kids, goes to bed. But then, like I said, Harold said that he checked on the kids at 12:30. And then somewhere along the lines, he also checked on them at 2:30. Now, interestingly, about 2:30, and this could be where the 2:30 time came from. Not from Harold seeing the kids, but in that Facebook Live, O'Brien said that around, he thinks, 2:30, though he can't be sure, Aisha got up, turned on the light, went to the bathroom, and came back. Now, the bathroom was, like, right across the hall from their bedroom. So she came back, turned off the light, and he just went right back to sleep. The next morning, Valentine's Day, also happened to be Harold and Aquila's wedding anniversary. Aquila says that she woke up at 5:45 and that she usually woke the kids up for school at about 6:30. But before she did that, she went to the bathroom, which was again across the hall from the kids' room, and started running a bath. The kids usually bathed at night before school, but because of the power outage, they didn't have a chance to.
Right.
So she's running the bath and she goes into the kids' room to wake them up. Now, when she goes in, she calls out Bryant's name and he popped up as usual. But that's when she realized that Aisha was no longer in her bed. In that Jet interview I mentioned earlier, Aquella described what happened next. And I want to read this part in her own words, again, just because so much of this is like a game of telephone.
Yeah, right.
That I feel like direct quotes about anything regarding timeline are kind of better. But, you know, keep in mind, this article is also from, I believe, 2008. So she's talking, you know, 8 years after her daughter disappeared. So this isn't a contemporaneous account. But she said, quote, "I looked beside his bed because sometimes she would get up at night and lay there. I asked him where she was. He didn't know. I checked the couch. I checked downstairs. I checked the kitchen. I checked every closet in the house. I went in my room and put on clothes and told my husband, Harold, that Aisha was not in the house. I checked our cars. She was not there. My husband said maybe she was in my mother-in-law's home. She lives across the road. We called my sister-in-law's house. She was not there. That's when I went into panic mode. I heard a car next door. I did not have shoes on. I put shoes on and ran outside. I called my mom and told her that Aisha was not in the house. She told me to hang up and call the police. I threw the phone at Harold and went outside." End quote.
Yeah, I mean, that's terrifying.
Yeah, absolutely. And everything she's doing seems like exactly what you would expect a parent to do when she wakes up and finds that her 9-year-old isn't in bed. You run around like a crazy person.
Yeah.
Call everybody you know, throw the phone at your husband's, you know, and run outside.
Why did she check in the closets?
Oh, I think because kids hide in closets. I used to hide in closets all the time.
Mm.
I think that was actually pretty normal. But yeah, I mean, and also you just got to check everywhere, you know. And thankfully, it's a fairly small house. So that whole neighborhood is full of like single family, like ranch homes, like one level kind of situations, probably about 1,200 square feet or so.
Yeah.
So she was able to check everywhere quickly. Police thankfully responded quickly, with the first officer arriving about 10 minutes after her 911 call.
And do we have kind of a time frame on that, or guess?
Yeah. So she realized Aisha's missing at about 6:30. I would give it 15 to 20 minutes probably before she made that 911 call. The first officer arrived before 7.
Okay.
Other members of the sheriff's department soon followed, and a canine unit was called in. During this initial, you know, kind of quick search, however, with the canine, the dogs could only pick up Aquila's scent, not Aisha's.
Hmm. That's interesting.
Well, yes and no. I mean, it's interesting that they couldn't pick up Aisha's scent, but Aquila had said that she had walked up and down the street screaming Aisha's name.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it makes sense that the dogs would kind of pick that up because she had just been going back and forth.
Yeah.
By 7 a.m., she said that they had every cop in the county there. Reporters also began to show up. Neighbors and the DeGrees family came out to search for the little girl. By noon, they had a helicopter with infrared searching the area. A command was set up at a nearby church. Police officers and volunteers searched until dark and then quickly resumed the next morning.
Well, it sounds like a pretty fast and robust response.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, basically the opposite of most of the cases that we cover. It seems like everything happened really, really quickly. And one of the things that I actually didn't know, but I found out in my research, is that the sheriff of Cleveland County, where they live, Sheriff Dan Crawford, had actually spent 22 years at the SBI, the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation.
Oh, wow.
Prior to becoming sheriff. And while he was there, he worked on many missing persons cases.
Oh, so this is kind of near and dear to his heart.
Yeah. And he actually is like, he has experience in this, yeah. Which nobody ever does in these cases, right?
Right, yeah.
And so, I mean, to have somebody who, like, has truly done this before is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Because reporters were on this story so quickly, we actually get a lot of information from the Charlotte Observer article that I mentioned that came out on February 15th, 24 hours after Aisha was reported missing.
Damn, that's quick.
It truly is. And, you know, typically when I look at these stories, it's usually a couple of days before we start seeing the first newspaper articles. And even then, it's like the very basic facts. Uh-huh. But this one has like the interview with Harold that I talked about where he's, you know, talks about his timeline. It has interviews with her cousins. Like it has a lot of information. So, for instance, we find out that Aisha went to bed wearing a white nightgown or nightshirt with a teddy bear on the front. Her parents also told reporters that the clothes she had been wearing during the day on Sunday, jeans, white tennis shoes, and a white t-shirt with purple lettering that had been made for a degree family reunion that had been held with Atlanta the previous summer. So, and the jeans are actually apparently white as well. So that outfit that she'd been wearing is missing, but it seems like her nightgown was also missing. So it doesn't look like she changed necessarily before she left.
But the clothes she was wearing during the day that she had changed out of are missing.
Mm-hmm. They also determined that her black backpack and a black purse with Tweety Bird on it were also missing. Aisha's house key was also presumably missing because she kept it in her backpack. And the doors were locked when Aquila woke up that morning.
She's sure of that.
Yes. She's sure that the doors were locked just as they were when she went to bed. And there was no sign of forced entry anywhere. The house itself looked completely normal. Other than Aisha being gone, the only other kind of weird thing about her room, you know, was, of course, the clothes and backpacks and stuff that were missing, but also that her bed wasn't made. So when Aisha woke up in the morning, she immediately made her bed. But her bed had been, you know, looked like it had been slept in, but was not made. A command post was set up on the afternoon of the 14th, and a group of over 60 people searched within a 3-mile radius around the Degree home. Investigators also began interviewing teachers and classmates of Aisha. No one at her school had any information about what could have happened to Aisha. She was a good student who had only missed one day of school that year, and that was back in September. She didn't seem to have any issues with anyone and had never talked about running away or anything of that nature. Because both the investigation and the news coverage happened so quickly, police received valuable tips on Monday evening.
Really?
Yeah. Because it was already on, like, the 5 o'clock news.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's super, super important, though.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And these witnesses claimed to have seen Aisha in the early morning hours of February 14th. So earlier that morning when she disappeared. Now, according to that February 15th article, two motorists called in and said that they believed that they had seen Aisha walking on the side of North Carolina State Route 18 between 3:30 and 4:15 a.m. Now, when I've read articles about this case or listened to podcasts, they usually describe Aisha as like walking on the side of a highway. So I just pictured something really remote and intimidating. But I actually finally just Google mapped it when I was researching this. And what this road actually is Falston Road, which is the first main road outside of her neighborhood. It basically runs parallel to her neighborhood. And it is a 2-lane highway, to be sure. I mean, the speed limit's 55, but it's not like a 4-lane highway. It's not like this huge, insane road, right?
Gotcha.
Like in the middle of nowhere. Like it's right outside of her neighborhood. It's the road that her bus took to go to school.
Okay. Did either of these eyewitnesses say what she was wearing?
Yes. So we get into that. This initial article doesn't get into that at all, but pretty soon these witnesses are tracked down and interviewed by the paper. There's also a lot of talk of woods in this case, but interestingly, while there are patches of woods, a lot of the land on either side of this road is cleared. It's either like somebody's property or a field or whatever. But the portion of road where the motorists claim to have seen Aisha is one of the woody parts. And it's just over a mile from her house.
And the timeline fits.
The timeline does fit, yeah. Now, it's the middle of the night and Aisha is 9. So obviously it's terrifying that she would have been walking on the side of the road, any road at all. It should also be noted, though, that Aisha left without a coat. The temperature around the time of these sightings was around 45 degrees Fahrenheit. But more importantly, a huge storm, another one, broke out. It rained heavily from about 3 a.m. until nearly 6 a.m., and winds got up to 36 miles per hour.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, the weather was horrible. And this little girl was out there, basically like in a nightgown. A few days later, on February 17th, reporters were able to get more information about these sightings. So this is what I talked about when they tracked down those witnesses. Jeff Rupp was a trucker who was on his regular route delivering for the Sundrop Bottling Company. He told reporters that he saw a little girl walking on the side of the road around 4 a.m. on Monday morning. He told reporters, quote, "I seen a little girl walking down the road with her book bag. She had on a little dress and white tennis shoes, and her hair was in pigtails. I went back, but she never did look up at me. She looked like she knew where she was going. She was walking at a pretty good pace," end quote.
White dress, or do we think that's the nightgown?
I think it's a nightgown. I mean, I think that it's 4 a.m. It's pitch dark.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he sees a nightgown. You would assume it was a dress. I mean,
sure.
You know,
yeah.
Like she's outside, right? He also mentioned that her hair was in pigtails, and Aisha's parents confirmed that her hair was in pigtails. Now, based on the lack of forced entry into the home, the missing items, and these motorist sightings, both Aisha's family and investigators believed that she had left the home of her own accord, though no one could figure out why this smart, happy 9-year-old girl who generally made smart decisions and was like deathly afraid of dogs would do such a thing.
And why did she pack her dirty clothes?
Well, yeah. And so that's the thing.
From the day before.
Now, later, we find out that she packed more clothes. But at the time, you know, the day she went missing, all they can figure out is that the clothes she had been wearing were missing.
Mm.
It would take a few days or however long for them to like go through the rest of her stuff and see what else was gone. And what else was gone was apparently, and this, I mean, the sources on this are kind of iffy, but from what I understand, what else was gone was like her favorite jeans and like a matching vest and a pair of Tweety Bird overalls. She had the Tweety Bird purse. And then I also read that she had taken her basketball uniform. But again, like this is a little sketchy. I'm not 100% on these items. But if this is true, she took several changes of clothes, including her basketball uniform.
Right.
And, you know, like her favorite clothes, like clothes that really kind of meant a lot to her.
Right. So the basketball uniform makes me wonder, wherever she was going, was she planning on getting to school eventually and going to practice, or was it more a sentimental thing?
You know, we'll talk about theories, of course, later, but like personally, I think it's because she was planning on going to basketball practice again. Cleveland County Sheriff Dan Crawford told the Charlotte Observer, quote, "My gut tells me at this point that foul play is involved," end quote. But in what way? Because at this point, you know, we're talking just a few days into the investigation, nothing was really off the table. They were investigating a possible abduction, of course, but there was also a possibility that Aisha had gotten hit by a car or that she was somehow injured and unable to seek help. And a lot of them thought that she was like out in the woods nearby somewhere. And with the temperature and, you know, what she was wearing, like they were frantically trying to find her because they truly thought that she was out there and, you know, needed help immediately. The thing that really bothers me about this is this whole time period after she leaves the house and she's apparently seen on the side of the road. The way the article reads, it seems as though Rupp and the other witnesses saw her between 1 and 1.5 miles away from her home. Now, this strikes me as a little bit odd because no one seemingly, again, you know, we're not privy to every tip that had been called in, but no one seemingly saw her closer to her house on what would have been the beginning of her journey. There were plenty of spots with very little on the side of the road, so she would have arguably been more visible closer to her home.
But isn't her home in more of a, I mean, it's a residential area.
No, it's so in maybe a developed, I don't mean in her neighborhood. I mean that, like, because the way she would have gotten out of her neighborhood, she would have, like, gotten out of her neighborhood and gotten to the road, to highway, or to Route 18, and walked down the side of the road for a mile before she was seen. And there are plenty of places where, like, it's much more clear on the side of the road, and there, where I think it would have been easier to see her than where she was actually seen. Mm. Now, there are no lights, as I mentioned earlier, like, anywhere on this road. So it's not as though she was in a better lit area that allowed for motorists to see her there as opposed to closer to her neighborhood. Other witnesses who ended up being interviewed were Roy Blanton Sr. and his son, Roy Jr. They were on a trucking run headed north on NC-18 when they saw someone walking south around 4:30 a.m. They were worried that she would be hit by a truck, so he used his CB radio to alert other truckers to this person. Blanton, a former Cleveland County Sheriff's deputy, said, quote, "It was a small figure wearing light-colored clothing. I thought it was a woman. I couldn't tell it was a child. I thought it might be a domestic violence thing where a woman left the house and was out walking," end quote. Which, like, okay, good that he used his CB radio to, like, warn truckers. But, like, even if you thought it was an adult and not a child, it's pouring down rain. This person isn't wearing a coat. They're walking on the side of a highway at 4:30 in the morning. Like, you're just going to keep it going?
Yeah, I mean, I had the same thought with the first witness. It was like, you know, the first witness even said, like, he could tell it was a little girl.
Yeah.
At 4:30 in the morning, whenever.
At 4, yeah.
He just kept on going.
Yeah, I always thought that was weird too. But we'll get a little bit more into his story and what he actually did do.
Oh, okay.
It's interesting because the next part of his story didn't come out in that first article. It didn't come out until a little bit later when he was, like, interviewed again. So I find this interesting. Now, Rupp, the first truck driver, was one of the original motorists who reported. But Blanton didn't hear about Aisha until Tuesday night, so he reported his sighting after that. So he either reported his sighting Tuesday night or, like, Wednesday morning. Because I feel like he said he didn't find out until the 10 o'clock news on Tuesday night, so it was late. I find this interesting because the article that came out on the 15th said that two motorists had called in and said that they had seen Aisha.
Right. So who's the second motorist that was referring to?
Right. Because Rupp said that he did find out Monday and called it in. So it stands to reason that he's one of the two. But I have no idea who that second one would have been because it doesn't seem like it was Blanton. But Rupp and Blanton are the only ones who have, like, been named
and interviewed. And
yeah. Yeah. They're the only ones that we actually know about. But it seems like there's at least one more out there. And a lot of the stories and, you know, things that have been written about this also say that there were several motorists. And to me, if there were only two, you know, that's not several. That's two or a few or a couple.
Right. Yeah.
But I'd be really curious to find out who that other one is and when they saw her. Because remember, the initial reports did say that the motorists saw her between 3:30 and 4:15. But Rupp says he saw her around 4. Blanton said he saw her around 4:30. So where did, like, the 3:30, 3:45, whatever, sighting come from?
Yeah.
Police sent out tracking dogs to comb the area between Aisha's neighborhood and where these sightings were, but they never picked up her scent. Tracking dogs apparently work better after it's rained because, like, the scent molecules get picked up in the raindrops, and it was raining at the time. But I don't know if because they came, like, a day later, if I don't know. But according to the article, they said that tracking dogs typically can find a scent up to, like, 3 or 4 days later.
That's interesting. I always... Maybe it's like an urban myth or whatever, but I always thought that, like, water messes with dog scent.
Yeah, but I've also read stories about tracking dogs who find or alert, you know, in the water.
Really?
Yeah. So like in a pond, like in a body of water. So I don't know. I think it's interesting that no tracking dogs ever picked up Aisha's scent anywhere. However, on Thursday, February 17th, there was a break in the case. Rupp, who incidentally took and passed a polygraph given by the FBI, took investigators to the spot where he saw Aisha. Now, this is where we get the rest of his story. And I don't mean to say that in a nefarious way, like he was holding things back. I'm sure he gave the entire story to the police.
Right. It just
I just mean from a newspaper perspective.
Yeah.
So he says that he actually drove by Aisha, you know, like you said, but it's dark as hell. The speed limit, like I mentioned, was 55. So he's going pretty fast. He passes by. He probably doesn't even really realize what he saw at first, right?
Yeah.
So he said he circled back around and kind of like, you know, just to see what actually was going on. This is what's weird. Is he says he actually ended up circling back around three times.
Before seeing her again?
I don't know. But on the third time, he did see her. And as he approached, she took off and ran into the woods. And it was really foggy at the time. So, like, she took off and he immediately lost sight of her.
Mm.
But even after all that, he didn't call 911. He only called police after he saw the news report about Aisha's disappearance.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to, you know, we're Monday morning quarterbacking.
Yeah.
And, like, thought process that early in the morning, what is he going to say when he calls the cops? He thought he saw a little girl out on the street and she ran away from him. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I don't know. Yes.
Yeah, sure. But we're taking it, we're looking at things through a lens of we know there's a missing girl and he didn't.
Sure. But he knows that there was a little girl who ran into the woods at 4 a.m. Like, that's not okay. And it's a storm. She doesn't have a coat on.
I'm just trying to not judge him.
Yeah, no, like this isn't about judging him. It's just about like, I don't know, man. Everything in this case from start to finish is incredibly confounding. Where he took investigators was about a mile away from Aisha's house and about a half a mile closer than where it seems Blanton says that he saw the girl, though, again, the time and the distance on these sightings is pretty iffy. Now, the location that Rupp took them to was on property owned by Charles Turner. Now, he owned an upholstery business at that location that still operates today, basically. That day, and we're talking about Tuesday.
Uh-huh.
Searchers were out on horseback, and they went onto the property and asked the Turners to take a look around, basically. They're like, hey, we got this report that this little girl kind of ran in this direction. Like, can you look around your property, see if you see anything weird? So Turner's upholstery co-owner, Rally Turner, searched the property with her daughter, and this included a doorless outbuilding that apparently used to be like a chicken house. Not like a chicken coop because it's like a full shed type situation, but apparently chickens used to be kept there a long time ago.
Okay.
But at this point, it held old furniture and farm equipment. Now, inside, when Rally went in there, they did find some weird items, including a school photo of a little black girl close in age to Aisha. Now, Rally told reporters that it's like not uncommon for photos to fall out of old furniture.
Mm.
And, you know, they had an upholstery business. Right. So, like, they obviously dealt with a lot of old furniture.
Yeah.
But, you know, she took the photo, handed it over to police, and they showed it to Aisha's family. The photo was not of Aisha, though, and it wasn't anybody that they recognized.
So it could have just been a random photo.
It could have been, absolutely. Now, frustratingly, because that photo didn't mean anything to the DeGree family, the Turners did kind of assume that it was just like a random photo that had fallen out of something and had nothing to do with anything. And because of that, they didn't turn over the other items that they had found in the building.
Okay.
So on Thursday, now this was all happening Tuesday. So 2 days later on Thursday, searchers were back out in the area and they found a candy wrapper by the same outbuilding. When they asked the Turners about this, they mentioned the other items that they had found, which they had kept and was basically just like in a pile on their porch. So when these items were shown to the Degrees, they freaked out because they immediately recognized some of them as belonging to Aisha. There was a yellow plastic hair bow, like a barrette basically, with a teddy bear in the middle, a pen, and a white pencil that said Atlanta on it. Now remember, the family had had their reunion the previous summer in Atlanta, and the shirt that she had worn on Sunday that was missing was from that reunion. There were also other candy wrappers, which would fit in with the fact that Aisha received Valentine's candy the weekend before her disappearance. Now, after this discovery, everybody who lived by this property was either interviewed or re-interviewed. And searchers performed what they called an inch-by-inch search in and around this building, but no other clues were found. After a week of intensive ground searches by hundreds of law enforcement officials and volunteers, totaling over 9,000 man hours, the ground search for Aisha was suspended indefinitely. Now, the suspension of the ground search did not mean a suspension in the investigation, of course, because they had these clues. Like, there was a lot to still be done. But I think what they determined after a week and 9,000 man hours is that
nothing is going to be found that hasn't already been found.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That, you know, she wasn't hurt in a ditch somewhere or something along those lines.
Yeah. So like, we have evidence that she was at this outbuilding, but there's no evidence that she died there or
came to any harm there or anything. Yeah.
She had a pencil that was from Atlanta. She purposely packed her clothes that she wore the day before that referenced the family reunion, right?
Yep.
Did her parents find it odd that the pencil was there?
No, because, I mean, not that I know, maybe, but I mean, nothing that's ever been said. It's entirely possible because this was her school backpack.
Oh, that maybe it was just in there.
Yeah, it could have just been in there. And, you know, the fact that the pencil and the shirt were there could have just been a complete coincidence. Apparently, there was also a marker that was found at the scene. I don't remember if I mentioned that or not. But yeah, like the barrette, the pencil, the marker, like all of that could have just been in her backpack. Now, one thing that police did that I thought was really interesting was a week after she went missing, in hopes of getting new witnesses, they set up a roadblock at 3 a.m., in the area where she was last seen, hoping to find people who like drive regularly on that road at that time.
That's pretty smart.
Yeah. So it was, I believe, a 3 hour long roadblock. It went from like 3 to 6 and they just stopped everybody who came by. Now, unfortunately, it doesn't seem like there were any more witnesses, but I think that was like a really
That's
cool thing to try.
That's really smart.
Now, there was also a tip line, of course, by this point, and, you know, we're a week into the case, and over 200 tips had come in, and so the Sheriff's Department was also combing through those. The FBI and the SBI were also investigating, so they both got into this case very quickly, and Crawford talked about that many years later, and, you know, I think it's because of his
experience and knowledge.
Yeah, he said that he called them in day one. Like, he wasn't messing around. As soon as he realized that, like, this girl hadn't just wandered off and was staying at a friend's house or whatever, like, he called them in. All right, let's get back to this outbuilding and why I find it so disturbing, other than the obvious, of course. In the article about Blanton, the second trucker who saw Aisha, he says that he saw her around 4:30. Rupp says that he saw her around 4:00. And when he came back, you know, the third time to take a look, she ran off away from the road. He then took investigators to the spot, which was the Turner property that I mentioned. Now, this property is almost exactly a mile away from her house. So it seems as though she got scared, probably because a trucker was circling around her multiple times.
Right.
And ran off, finding shelter in this outbuilding.
Mm-hmm.
And to be clear, this is basically the theory that the sheriff gave to reporters.
I mean, it makes sense with the eyewitness reports.
Right. The Charlotte Observer article from February 17th says, quote, "Ground searchers continue to focus on an area along NC-18 about 1.5 miles south of Aisha's house," end quote. Now, the intersection of 18 and 180 is another 0.5 mile down the road, making it about 1.5 miles from Aisha's house. So if Blanton's sighting was closer to that intersection, the 0.5-hour difference in the two sightings would make sense.
Uh-huh.
Perhaps Aisha hid out for a little while before setting back off on her walk.
Uh-huh.
However, and I'm going to say everything I'm about to say, because I think that this is important, but I will say that the difference between where the two truckers saw Aisha and the times could be chalked up to simply they were a little bit off on their measurements or their times.
Sure.
Or the reporters were a little bit off on their measurements and their times, right? Mm-hmm. So I do want to give that caveat. However, according to another Charlotte Observer article by Joe DePriest, in order for Aisha to reach that outbuilding from the road where she was seen, she would have had to walk the length of 2 football fields uphill and cross a 3-foot-deep gully. So this outbuilding was not off of the side of the road. It was not visible from the side of the road. There is no reason that she would have known it was there.
Unless she had previous knowledge.
Right. But to everybody's knowledge, her family, whoever, they didn't know the Turners. The Turners didn't know her. She had uh-huh. never been there. She had never had any occasion to be there. They had never, like, gone to there for upholstery services.
Yeah.
Nothing. Like, there's no reason that she ever would have been on that property prior to this night. So, okay. So let's say that that's... For whatever reason she did it, she takes off in the rain, in the fog, into the woods, runs 2 football fields uphill, crosses a gully, this 9-year-old girl, athletic 9-year-old girl, but still. She then gets into this outbuilding that's full of farm equipment and old furniture.
Eats a bunch of candy.
Eats a bunch of candy, drops a pencil, drops a marker, drops a barrette.
And then hikes it back out.
Yeah, gathers up her stuff, hikes it back out, and continues down the highway, heading south, where she's then spotted by Blanton and his son. And, you know, it just seems like a lot for a 9-year-old who's deathly afraid of dogs to do at 4 a.m. in the rain. Oh, and speaking of dogs, Reverend Mackie Turner, another Turner relative, he apparently lived in a mobile home on the property, and kept 6 beagles in a dog run right behind the outbuilding.
Now, okay.
We've had a beagle. We've had one beagle.
Yes.
One singular old ass beagle.
Very loud.
Yeah.
Very quick, even in her old age, to bark and respond to people in or coming into or around our house.
Oh, yeah. God forbid we left the windows open, right?
Right. So zero chance that these beagles didn't hear her and start going ballistic.
Right. And that's what Reverend Turner said. He said that these dogs would bark their heads off
yes.
if anyone came near them. But he heard nothing that night.
Mm.
The investigation continued, but the number of full-time investigators assigned to Aisha's case dwindled. The first anniversary of her disappearance came the following February, a day shared with her parents' 13th wedding anniversary. The DeGrees started an annual walk from their home to the stretch of road where she was last seen in order to keep up awareness in their daughter's case. But then, in August 2001, 1.5 years after she was last seen, a major clue was unearthed. Literally.
Thank you.
In August 2001, construction workers were grading a path for a driveway in Burke County, about 25 miles away on NC 18 South, the road on which Aisha was last seen.
25 miles away, though?
Yep. So they're grading this driveway, and they made a shocking discovery. They uncovered a black plastic bag. Inside of this plastic bag was another plastic bag. Inside of that plastic bag was a black backpack. The backpack had Aisha's name and number in it. The construction workers were so freaked out by this that they immediately called police because I don't think they necessarily even knew who Aisha was. Like, I don't think they recognized the name, but like a double wrapped backpack in the middle of nowhere was very concerning to them.
Yeah, it's not good.
So police came, of course, to the site, and they took the backpack into evidence, and they called Aisha's parents. And Aquila says, she's like, yeah, at that moment, I thought the next thing they were going to tell me is that they found a body.
Right.
Investigators didn't immediately release the full contents of the backpack, but early reports said that it contained clothing, a piece of paper, and a pencil case. The backpack and its contents were immediately sent to FBI headquarters in Quantico for testing, but it would be years before police would release more specific information on the items found in the backpack. But I think the detail of the pencil case is interesting because I hadn't actually read that before, and that was in like one of the original news articles from 2001. Because what tends to get focused on now about the backpack is what police released about the backpack many years later.
Okay.
So that was the first time that I had heard about the pencil case and the piece of paper that had originally been found in the backpack. But the pencil case makes sense given what we found in the outbuilding.
Right.
An intense search of the property was launched, both aerial and ground. They combed that property, but while many feared that they would find Aisha's body, no further trace of the little girl was found. Now, I have read that a pair of men's khaki pants was recovered during the search, but no information about any test results from that have been released. And it's just unclear as if that had anything to do or if it was even like close to where the backpack was found or just elsewhere on the property.
Gotcha.
Now, after such a huge break in the case, shockingly, it went dormant for several more years. In 2014, a man named Donald Ferguson was arrested for murdering 7-year-old Sholanda Poole in Greensboro, North Carolina. Police suspected that he could have been in or around Cleveland County at the time of Aisha's disappearance, so they looked into him as a possible suspect, but no connection could ever be made. In 2015, the FBI decided to take a fresh look at Aisha's case. The next year, in 2016, they released a new tip that they had received, but I'm not sure about when they received the tip.
Okay.
They just released it in 2016. According to the FBI, someone matching Aisha's description was seen getting into a car on Highway 18 around the area where she was last seen. The vehicle was described as an early 1970s Lincoln Mark IV or a Ford Thunderbird with rust around the wheel wells. And this was green. And we'll have pictures of those types of cars on the blog, so you can kind of take a look at them. But, you know, this is interesting, and I don't know when they received this tip, but that is the first time that, you know, anybody reportedly saw Aisha after those two truckers did.
I mean, I'm assuming that they did this, but did they go to Aisha's parents and say, do you know anybody that would have this car or this type of car?
I have to assume so, because I mean, Aisha's parents have maintained heavy involvement in this case.
Yeah.
So yeah, but you know, the FBI doesn't really like to talk. So, you know, we just unfortunately don't have a lot more information on that. 2 years later, in 2018, the sheriff's office released some information about two items found in Aisha's bag. A copy of Dr. Seuss's McElligot's Pool and a New Kids on the Block concert t-shirt.
Hmm.
Now, the book was from Aisha's school library, but and though I haven't seen this explicitly stated anywhere, it doesn't seem that it was checked out to her. Though it also hasn't been stated that it was like checked out to another kid.
Hmm.
So I don't know if it was checked out at all, or if it was checked out to her. Nobody specifically mentioned that, but it was from her school library. But her parents apparently like had no idea that she had had this book.
That's interesting.
Yeah. The New Kids on the Block t-shirt, on the other hand, definitely did not belong to Aisha.
And this was found in her backpack.
Yeah. After it was recovered in 2001, though police didn't release this information until 2018. You know, no offense to Donnie and the gang, but in 2000, NKOTB was a little past their heyday.
Sure was.
So it doesn't seem like a group that a 9-year-old would have been into. And, you know, to that point, like, her family never mentioned her even knowing who they were, much less like wanting a shirt. And she definitely didn't have a shirt. As for the pencil case or any other items that may have been in the backpack, you know, like the clothes that she had packed, authorities haven't released that information publicly. So in the end, the items from this backpack that police released, like, just led to more questions than answers. Because the shirt, at the very least, almost certainly wasn't something that she packed.
Right.
The book likely wasn't either.
But it's from her school.
Right.
Which means whoever put it there has ties to the school.
That's what it would seem like. And then, you know, you have the school picture that was found, which could just be a red herring, because, you know, it was not identified as anybody who had gone to her school.
Okay.
To this day, it's never been identified. So it truly could have fallen out of like an old piece of furniture and be completely unrelated to this case, or it could just be like another weird, mysterious item that Aisha had in her backpack that didn't actually belong to her. In 2020, an inmate in prison, who I'm not going to bother to name because like he doesn't need to get his name out there, he was in prison for child sex abuse, wrote a letter to Shelby Star, which is a local newspaper, saying, quote, "Aisha Degree has been missing for over 20 years. About 4 months ago, I had found out her whereabouts and what had happened to her. She was killed and then took and buried. I do know how and what town she is in. I hope you get this letter and do come see me. It's on the up and up," end quote.
Bullshit.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it was total bullshit. Police, of course, followed up.
Yeah.
They went to the location that the inmate, you know, told them to go to. A search turned up animal bones, but nothing related to Aisha. The years after Aisha's disappearance were obviously difficult for the Degree family. Harold was actually in a terrible car accident about a year after her disappearance and was hospitalized, like in critical condition for quite some time. Thankfully, he recovered. O'Brien ended up attending college, but, you know, had issues for sure. But he also had a baby when I think he was like 18 or 19. She's now a teenager and she looks so much like Aisha. O'Brien actually talked about how difficult it was when his daughter was around Aisha's age because their looks and mannerisms were so similar. And, you know, they were only, he and his sister were only 11 months apart. And so it's like, you know, he knew like every bit about her. And to see that reflected in his own daughter, I think was both incredibly difficult, but also probably pretty joyful as well. So, okay, let's talk. We got to talk a little bit about theories. So that's basically it. And it's wild how these huge, crazy things happen in this case, right? Like, you've got the people who see this little girl on the side of the road in the middle of the night. You have the fact that she's out there with no coat, no, you know, in the middle of a flipping rainstorm. You have the items found in the outbuilding. You have the fact that the outbuilding's far away from the road.
Right.
You have the backpack double bagged and found 25 plus miles away from where she was last
seen. I still
have
questions about that.
Okay. I don't know if I can answer them because, you know.
Okay, so this construction crew is grading the land for a driveway.
Yeah.
Whose fucking driveway?
I don't know.
Like, what was that property?
I don't know. I mean,
What was the property? So it was 25 miles away. What was the property? And they found it when?
2001 in August.
A year and a half.
Yeah.
So whose property or what was on the property a year and a half previous to that when she went missing?
So I don't really know. From what I can, what I understand from, you know, witnesses, I think it was a property that was owned by somebody, but it was adjacent to maybe other people's properties. And I see that because one of the people who was interviewed was this 15-year-old kid nearby who, like, I guess there was like a pond or something around where the backpack was found that was a fishing hole that he would go to.
Okay.
So it sounds like it was a place that like people would go to for things like that. But it wasn't like his property or his family's property, you know?
They're grading, like, how far down was it buried? Like,
well, yeah,
you know what I mean?
Like,
I have so many questions.
Like, buried, or like,
was it
just in the brush?
Right, because grading land doesn't require you to go down
far.
Very far.
Yeah, no, right. For sure.
It's just about, you know, not necessarily leveling, but kind of leveling the earth to lay asphalt or concrete or whatever.
Yeah.
So, like, yeah. Was it just thrown into the brush? Did it come out of the ground?
And again, I mean, this is an area that people apparently kind of walked around and were around, but nobody had seen it. So how long had it been there? Had it been there for a year and a half? Was it put there more recently?
Right.
Why was it put there? Because let's say it's like put there by the person who took Aisha. Like, why double bag it and leave it there? Just throw it in a dumpster. Like,
right.
Why would you not destroy it in some way?
Right. Why there? That's,
yeah.
Yes.
But I mean, again, you know, the FBI, of course, very tight lips, everything.
I'm sure that these are all questions that they have.
Oh, of course.
I want to know about the bags.
Yeah.
Double bagged in what way? Was it just like tied?
Sounds like it was just tied.
Was it duct taped or anything?
No, there was no duct tape.
So
I think
just,
they were just tied.
What type of bags was it? Like,
yeah, just black plastic bags is how. I don't know if they were the large trash bags or like the smaller shopping bags.
Right, yeah. No, these are the questions that
I
have.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, and then, of course, obviously, like...
And if they were trash bags, were they kitchen bags? Were they carpenter bags?
Right.
Were they... Yeah, I'm not sure.
Was it heavy-duty construction bags?
Right.
Like, what are we talking about here? You know, of course, then you have the t-shirt. I mean, 2000, you're talking about... NKOTB was...
That was 80s.
Big in the 80s. So
yeah.
You're talking about a like, 15 to 20 year gap.
Yeah. Like their heyday was before she was born.
Yes. And there have been many. This is
2000.
This is post resurgence of the other boy bands.
This is Backstreet Boys. This is NSYNC.
Right.
This is 98 Degrees.
Yes.
Like, yeah.
So, like, what the hell does that mean?
I don't know.
So but many questions.
What I keep going back to, and, you know, there are, like I said, a billion and a half theories on this case. But in my research, I came across this website, Finding Aisha Degree, Shelby Sweetheart. And it brings up a couple theories that I find interesting. And given what we know about the trucker sightings, the location of the outbuilding, and just Aisha's general personality, I don't know. I kind of agree. And so my personal theory on what happened to Aisha, and again, you know, who am I? But I do believe, like everybody, you know, her family and police believe that she left her house of her own accord.
Well, I mean, the evidence points to that. Like,
exactly.
There's no other, I don't think that is something that can really be disputed.
Right, right. And so I believe she did.
Doors locked, still being locked
when
her mom finds her, indicates that she left and locked the door behind her.
Right. You know, she's walking alone, like, you know, it makes sense. While those circumstances point to a runaway story, that doesn't fit either.
Right.
Because, again, she came from a healthy, happy, loving household. She had family, friend, and community support.
Uh-huh.
She was actively involved in, you know, school, extracurriculars, church. She was 9 years old. And, you know, in the articles that came out, like, you know, NCMEC, of course, was involved. And they're like, yeah, this doesn't make sense. Like, we don't see 9-year-old runaways. Like, typically that doesn't start till age 12.
Right.
And typically it's not people in Aisha's circumstances either. So, like, the runaway theory doesn't make sense. They didn't have a computer. She didn't obviously, like, have a cell phone or anything. So the idea of her being groomed online
Yeah, I mean, that's out.
Yeah, it doesn't seem likely. Like, yes, could she have gone to the school library and gotten on? Like, yes.
Sure, but that wouldn't be regular enough contact.
Right.
Especially given that she went missing over a weekend.
Exactly, yeah. That doesn't make sense either. So what I truly believe is that Aisha was abducted. I do not believe that it was a crime of opportunity.
No, there had to have been planning behind this.
Yeah, I don't believe that, let's say, Blanton put the call on the CB radio and said, like, hey, there's somebody walking on the side of the road, like, don't run him over. And then, like, some murderous trucker was like, oh, now is my chance, yeah.
No,
right?
No, zero chance. Because, like, there's zero chance of it being a crime of opportunity because, how did she get out there then?
What do you mean, like, get out where?
Like, you were saying it's the truck driver saw her, put it out on the CB radio, and then all of a sudden somebody took the opportunity to abduct her then.
Yeah.
Why was she out there?
In the first place.
Already, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, no. Like, that doesn't fit either.
Exactly, because, like, so I guess one of the theories was that she had decided to run away and then was the victim of a crime of opportunity. But I don't buy that because I don't believe she decided to run away.
Yeah, it doesn't fit.
No, I mean, it's clear she decided to leave that night.
Yes.
What I truly believe is that somebody close to her,
mm-hmm.
somebody she knew, somebody she trusted, whether it is somebody at school, family member, somebody at church, somebody involved with basketball, somebody who is regularly in her life. I think that person had been grooming her.
Yeah.
And I think that person convinced her to leave that night. And I think it was planned ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that it was related to either her parents' anniversary or Valentine's Day or both, which was the next day. Now, we know that Aisha was a kind and loving person, and we know that she was a people pleaser. And so I can absolutely see a scenario in which somebody she knew and trusted said, help me plan a great surprise. Whether it's a surprise for her parents, a surprise for the whole family, like whatever, help me plan this surprise. They're, you know, doing whatever they're doing to lead up to it. I don't know what the surprise is. I don't know if it's a gift, if it's a party, if it's, you know, whatever, right? But I think it's part of that surprise. They said, listen, you're going to leave in the middle of the night. You're going to take your stuff, you know, take your favorite outfit, right? Like take what you would want to wear. That's why I kind of think it's like an event, more of an event than a gift. Because like she brought her favorite outfit with her. Take your favorite outfit, you know, I'll come get you. We're going to leave when everybody's sleeping. And then we'll come back in the morning with the surprise, or they will have finished whatever they needed to finish for the surprise. But either way, I truly believe that Aisha was convinced to leave the house because she thought she was going to be doing something good for somebody. And I think that she thought she was going to be coming back, which if she did in fact take her basketball uniform, I think that kind of feeds into that. And again, I don't know the details, right? Like, because it's like, well, if he said she was coming back in the morning, why would she need to take her basketball uniform? Why couldn't she have just gotten it then? Maybe he said, you know, well, I'll take you to school. It'll be like, I don't know. I don't know what the story was, right?
We probably don't know this, but do we know when her next basketball practice was?
I don't know. No.
Because that would be interesting to know.
Yeah. So I do believe that this person arranged to meet her at a specific time. But what I don't know is how she knew when to leave.
Yeah, wait, hang on. The power went out. So how did she wake herself up?
That's my question. So the power was back on by the time she left.
Right, but the power wasn't back on by the time, like, she was asleep when the power came back on.
Presumably, yeah. When her parents checked on her, she appeared to be asleep. Now, I don't know what the clock situation was in her room. So I don't know if, like, they had a clock at all.
Right.
And if they did, if it was plugged in or battery operated. If it was battery operated, then no big deal. She knew what time it was.
Yeah. but her brother at one point said that he thought she had gotten up at around 2:30.
Mm-hmm. And gone to the bathroom.
Right. He's assuming that because he didn't know what time it was.
Right. But that doesn't necessarily mean that he didn't have a clock. It could just be that he didn't look at a clock because he was half asleep and didn't care.
Sure.
So, yeah. And so we don't know if the 2:30 part of that is accurate at all. Now, interestingly, also for years, it had been reported that like he had kind of woken up because he heard a creak in her bed and then just kind of went back to sleep. It wasn't until this Facebook Live that I had seen, and maybe this did come up before, but in most of the things that I read, it was like he heard a creak and kind of like, you know, knew she was awake and then he went back to sleep, whatever. But in the Facebook Live in 2020, it's when he said that she had gotten up and gone to the bathroom and come back. So let's assume that it was around 2:30. She's up. She knows when to meet them. If that's the case, and the person was in a car waiting for her, that would explain why her scent was never picked up anywhere.
Right.
Because if she had walked from her house to where she had been seen, it would stand to reason that her scent would be picked up. So was she picked up? The thing that doesn't make sense about that is then, were all of the motorists wrong? Like, how could they be wrong about seeing a little girl on the side of the road?
Now, well, I mean, and also, then we have evidence of her actually being at that outbuilding.
Right. That's the other thing. Now, this is the part of the theory that the author brought up on the blog, which I find extremely interesting. So what if the person did pick her up and it was prearranged?
And either took her to that outbuilding.
Well, yes or no, actually. So what if it was prearranged and either the person was there to pick her up or the person lived nearby and it wasn't a prearranged time necessarily. It was just supposed to be sometime after everybody's asleep and she just happened to wake up at 2:30 to go to the bathroom and she's like, okay, well, I guess now's the time, and decides to leave and goes and meets this person. So let's say the person's, I don't know, maybe the person comes to her, maybe she goes to them, but either way, it's a car and the car's nearby. Now, the theory that this person came up with that I find interesting is that the sightings were done on purpose to make it seem as though she was a runaway, or, you know, that she had decided to leave of her own volition and left on her own and kept on going on her own. So what they think could have happened is that Aisha could have been driven to around where she was seen, let out of the car, and the car, you know, hid somewhere off of the road, and she walked in this area specifically so passing motorists would see her. I know. Again, it's a theory. Like, nobody fucking knows.
Yeah, nobody knows, but that's, I mean, that's some deep conspiracy shit right there.
Maybe. But, you know, nothing else makes sense. You know, I feel like everything's crazy, right? So the theory goes that, like, okay, they do this. The person who takes her is confident that she was seen. They pick her up. They take her to wherever they take her to do whatever it is they did. Aisha is reported missing the next morning. Shit starts, like, popping off, right? I don't know if this was maybe part of the original plan or maybe the person was, like, panicking and, you know, wanting to try to throw the investigation off more. But I personally am kind of with the theory that Aisha was never in that outbuilding. I kind of believe that those items were planted there by her abductor. And I think that they were planted sometime between when she left her house and when it was searched Tuesday morning. So we're talking about a 24-hour period. Now, the problem with that is that presumably, depending on when this person went to plant the items, the dogs might have
alerted.
Reacted.
Right.
But what if it was the middle of the day, you know, and maybe the dogs did alert, but like the people who live there weren't around or they were busy or they wouldn't have noticed, or it's the middle of the day. And so maybe they saw a deer and freaked out about that, you know, could that person have made it to that outbuilding and planted those items, not like in the middle of the night, you know, maybe during the day, maybe early evening, maybe dusk, like maybe, you know, sometime where the people and maybe even the dogs would have been otherwise engaged.
I mean, I don't know. Like, this is... But then she was also seen in that general area. Yes, I get that the outbuilding is far off of the road, but she was seen in that area as well.
But remember, people knew very early on about those sightings. They knew about those sightings on Monday, right? So it could have been after the person who took her found out about those sightings that they decided they needed to like really lean into that. And then decided to plant the items in the outbuilding to establish that she alone, quote unquote, had gone up there. And so then, because then
that would require the person actually having knowledge about that building being there too.
Yes, it would. It absolutely would. But, you know, if you look at it like as a way to throw off the investigation, I mean, it did, because they heavily concentrated on that area for the next several days. And they weren't really, I mean, you know, they were looking other places, but the vast majority of the manpower was in the area on that property. So if Aisha had never been on that property, it's a pretty good misdirection.
Sure. Yeah.
What I can't figure out is the bag, why it was double wrapped, why it was there, other than further misdirection. But again, it's a year and a half later. So like,
well, but we also don't know when it was planted.
Yeah, I know. Exactly. So I don't know about the bag. The bag is just confusing to me no matter which way you look at it. So the other thing about this like crazy like theory
conspiracy theory?
Yeah, it's not a conspiracy theory. It's not a conspiracy if it's like one person.
Okay, fine.
But no, this theory is that could also work with the green car. Like what if this person had the green car, right? And that, you know, there was a witness who saw her getting into the car, depending on when and where they saw her getting into the car, which we don't know the specifics of that. That could have theoretically been after she was seen mm-hmm. by the motorist. She was getting back in the car mm-hmm. to go complete whatever plan it was.
I don't know. That's a lot.
It's a lot. But that's why this is just one of the weirdest cases. And yeah. This is one that, you know, people have requested over the years, and I haven't done because I'm like, how am I going to even get into into this, right? Because yeah. like it's also one of those ones that's been talked about on a lot of different podcasts and things, and so it's like everybody has their own theories, and I kind of try to stay away from stuff like that sometimes. But
well, yeah, because you're spitting into the wind.
Yeah,
like we can look at the evidence and come up with, I don't want to call it a crazy theory, but a very, very detailed theory that you just presented, which very well could be true, but it could be completely wrong.
Yeah.
Because, again, we're just throwing theories out. I mean, I will agree with several things. I do think that this was somebody that was close to her.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that they were grooming her to leave for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that the articles of clothing that she took with her and the specificity of it being related to the family reunion,
mm-hmm.
I think that needs to be looked into a little bit further.
Mm-hmm.
What are the age ranges of the people that were at the sleepover? The cousins, the...
Oh, I mean, I think it was all over, you know?
Right.
Like I said, I know one of the cousins was 15. I think another one was 12. And I'm, you know, Aisha was 9. Like I think it was just like a wide range.
Okay. I'm just wondering if that maybe even had something to do with it. Because it was the previous night, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It was Saturday night.
And who else was there other than the cousins?
Yeah. I'm assuming aunts, uncles. I mean, who knows? Like, that's the thing. It's a lot of family around.
Right.
And of course,
I know. I don't want to say it, but.
Right. And that's.
The thought is there.
Yeah.
That maybe it was a family member.
Yeah. And that thought absolutely crossed my mind. What I do want to say about that is police have said that, you know, they, of course, interviewed all of the family members, obviously, especially because they all lived right there.
Right.
They've never identified any of them as suspects. And specifically when it comes to her parents, Sheriff Crawford has specifically said that he does not believe that they have had any involvement in their daughter's disappearance.
No, and I would, I mean, the evidence of that is not there.
No, it's not. And, but I want to bring it up because, yeah, you know, during my research, I, of course, ended up on one of the many bazillion Reddit threads on this case. Uh-huh. I ended up on a couple of them. And, you know, down in the comments somewhere, somebody had said something around like, oh, the parents know more than they're saying. And to which somebody said, well, the parents were cleared. And then it was like, well, who cleared them? Like, you know, when was this cleared? People always say that, but they never show receipts, you know, blah, blah, blah. But so I do want to specifically say that.
Here's the receipt. Yes.
Yeah. And I do have like the link to the articles in the sources for this. So like you can see it for yourself. Sheriff Crawford did specifically clear the parents. He did not specifically clear anybody else.
Right. I don't, and when I'm saying family members, I'm not saying immediate.
Right.
I'm saying that they're, again, this is all just theory and conjecture.
Oh, absolutely. We don't know anything.
Right. But to me, it looks more as though somebody close to her, i.e. a family member.
Right. But again, it's hard to say because, yes, absolutely, it could have been a family member. And, you know, that's kind of what I was alluding to when I said that she could have just been going to the person who was close by. Right.
Right.
But that doesn't even mean that it's a family member. It could have been another non-family neighbor.
Yeah.
You know,
that's true.
I mean, she had lived in that same house her entire life. Like, chances are she knew a lot of people in that neighborhood. So even the theory of her going to meet the person nearby doesn't mean that it's anybody in her family.
That's true.
She was in church. She was in basketball. She was in school. Like, there are a lot of places where this person could have gotten close to her.
Yeah.
It's just unbelievable that it's been 23 years and we still don't know. We still don't know a whole lot more than we knew in 2000. And despite decades of questions and no resolution, the DeGree family has remained steadfast in their belief that Aisha is still out there alive. Akilah told the FBI, quote, "I still believe my daughter is alive. I do not believe she is dead. And I know somebody knows something. I'm not crazy enough to think that a 9-year-old can disappear into thin air. We're hoping and we're praying that she's had a halfway decent life anyway, even though we didn't get to raise her. We've missed everything, but I don't care. If she walked in the door right now, I wouldn't care what I missed. All I want to do is see her," end quote. Aisha Jaquila DeGree has been missing from Shelby, North Carolina since February 14, 2000. She's a black female with black hair and pigtails and brown eyes. She's approximately 4'6" and 60 pounds at the time of her disappearance. She was last seen wearing a white nightshirt or nightgown with a teddy bear on the front and white size 3 Nike tennis shoes. She was carrying a black backpack. Aisha was 9 years old when she went missing. She would be 33 today. Anyone with information on the disappearance of Aisha DeGree is asked to call the Cleveland County Sheriff's Office at 704-484-4788 or the FBI at 704-672-6100. There is a $45,000 reward for information that can help solve this case. You can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by me, Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketza. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!
If you're an HVAC technician and a call comes in, Grainger knows that you need a partner that helps you find the right product, fast and hassle-free. And you know that when the first problem of the day is a clanking blower motor, there's no need to break a sweat. With Grainger's easy-to-use website and product details, you're confident you'll soon have everything humming right along. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.